This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends. It's your boy, Michael Cruz Kane, and I'm back with another episode of What? A Good Cry. You know it. It's A Good Cry, your favorite podcast about being sad, getting over it, not getting over it, whatever it is you're doing. It's your favorite podcast about that. Thank you for emailing me. Thank you for DMing me, etc. That email again is agoodcry@theradiopoint.com. And I appreciate your subscriptions, your ratings, your reviewings, your sharings, your listenings. Thank you for being there and being such a great and supportive fan base. And actually, as some of you have already noticed and messaged me, because the fan base has been so good and growing, we are starting to get ads on the podcast. I hope you enjoy them. I'm only doing ads for products that I myself use and like and trust, so hopefully they will be not painful for you to listen to. Okay, that part of the podcast is over, and on to grief thoughts. This week, I talk with Stephanie Whittles Walks. She is a podcaster, a podcast entrepreneur, as well as an author. We talk about her brother, Harris, and other things. One thing that she brought up that I feel like we haven't really teed up as a conversation topic that I just wanted to talk a little bit more about right here is what you can do for people who are right there in the worst part of grieving, the early part, who are still at like the ground zero of their sadness. And that is just do the thing you think they might want without asking them. That has to be within reason, obviously. I mean, like, don't murder someone or steal somebody's identity or anything. But like, if you're getting a gift for someone, just go ahead and get it. That would be my advice. If you are going to do a chore for someone, just go ahead and do it. That would be my tip. Do not ask, "Hey, if there's anything I can do for you, would you just let me know?" Because that is the same thing as saying, "I am not going to help you." Because the people who are grieving are too overwhelmed with stuff. Too many people saying that to them to have to go through every email and be like, yes, thank you, Yolanda. If you could do this, and then Steven, if you could do this, and then Dashiell, if you could do this, and then Javier, if you could do this. We don't have time for that. We're dealing with our own stuff. We are not going to be able to go through a series of emails and answer every one of them. We are laying face down on the floor. With that, I take you to today's guest who I've already mentioned, Stephanie Whittles Wax. We had an amazing conversation that I really enjoyed. I've wanted to talk to her for a long time. Her brother Harris was a comedian who died of a drug overdose. We talk about the impact of that loss and how it affected her life. We are interrupted several times by dogs. We'll probably edit most of those dog interruptions out. But that's reality, man. That's real. Even when you're going through the worst stuff, the dogs do not stop barking. This is Stephanie Whittles Walks on a new episode of A Good Cry. Thanks for listening. I hope it helps. You're the best. Bye. Where is your house? Where are you at?
So I'm in California.
Okay, cool.
I'm in Carmel right now. I live in Monterey. We're moving to Pacific Grove, like hopefully tomorrow if the floor is dry.
Okay, we're sealing the floor? What are we doing?
Yeah. We're like sealing the floor. It's like, I don't know. I'm there's a lot of crying I've been doing over ceilings of floors and ceilings in general.
Ceilings of ceilings.
Yeah.
We moved not that long ago. I live in Brooklyn, and we had water on our floor because our basement flooded during like Hurricane Ida and Hurricane whatever it was. Like in our basement, the water was like up to my chest. It was 4 feet of water in the basement. And you're like, well, this is so bad.
I have that same story actually in New York. When I lived in New York, I was in Alphabet City, and we were living in a basement apartment, which was actually just like a cellar that they illegally had like said was a basement apartment.
Uh-oh.
And we came home one day and it was like up to, yeah. I mean, I'm like 5 feet tall. So it's like, you know, we were like swimming in it.
Oh, no.
And then all the hot firemen came over and we were like, hey. So there was a silver lining.
You're just like, it's totally.
And I didn't own it. It wasn't my fucking house. So I was like, this isn't my problem.
That is the benefit of renting is that when your whole place is an aquarium, you're like, I guess I don't care. I live somewhere else now.
Yeah. I don't care. I live somewhere else. Yeah. Have fun taking care of this shit. Yeah. So anyway, so let me orient you to where I am. So there's like in California, there's Southern California, there's like LA, then there's Central Coast, which is like Big Little Lies, Big Sur territory.
I appreciate it. Now, if you go by TV shows, then I will know where you are.
So I'm like near there, but not the most beautiful part. But that's the area of the country where we are in is Big Little Lies country.
Oh, The dog was on the bed the whole time?
Yeah, I'm going to close this door. I'm so sorry. This is like...
No, that's fine.
There's two of them. They are so annoying. I'm sorry. There's going to be dogs barking. I don't know. I can't control anything at this point.
Yeah, I understand. I understand that feeling. Okay, so... Anyway, this is a podcast about where you live specifically. You describe it to the listeners, and that's all that it is.
Great. Then I'm done.
A little bit of talking about your floors, then where you live, and then we're done.
It's riveting.
Steph, I'm calling you Steph. I'm taking the plunge into calling you Steph, which you gave me permission to do. You almost said you preferred it. Okay.
Yeah, I love it.
Okay, here we are. We're Steph. We're friends. We're very close. A question we kick it off with that's a little open-ended is, would you tell me about your relationship with grief today? What's your vibe with grief right now?
Oh, okay. I have like a, I'm a professional griever. I'm a career griever. I grieve for a living. I mean, we're very close. It grief pays the bills. It butters the bread. It fries the bacon. Yeah, I didn't like when I was a kid sort of like go, yeah, I want to just like exclusively focus on the worst fucking things that can happen to you, you know, but somehow I have found myself here. So yeah, I am grieving. I am talking to people about their grief. I am getting DMs about people's grief. I'm like in it all the time.
Yeah, you're like, it's a thing that you have, like, the word I want to say that I know is not an English word. Here's the word I'm almost saying. Dove in into, which is, I'm trying to make a past tense of dive, but my brain doesn't want to do it. The dived? Dive, dove?
No, dove. I like dove in.
Submerged.
Yeah.
Dove in.
Yeah.
Okay, great. You have dove in into the grief world, which I think, I mean, that can be overwhelming. Is it? Sometimes it must be.
Yes, yes, you nailed it. I try to quit my job every day, which is hard because I own my company, so I really can't. But I do sort of send a resignation letter to my partner like every week where I'm like, I've quit. I'm not doing this anymore. And she's like, fuck off. I'll talk to you tomorrow. It is. In all seriousness, it is sometimes a bummer, right? Like sometimes I'm like, I wish I did data entry. That would be, I don't know. Maybe I could go just do data entry and show up at 9 and plug in numbers and then go eat lunch and then come back to my desk and then plug in more numbers and then go home and then not think about anything sad, you know? Like, what kind of life would that be? But unfortunately, that's not how I'm wired. That wasn't how I was wired before my entire life fell apart. And, you know, I am a thinker. I am a feeler. I'm a deep diver. I'm a dove-in. I'm a dove-in kind of gal. I'm a dove-in. So yeah.
We're going to have it printed on beanies, dove-in.
Yeah. I do also, like, there is this very sort of earnest part that I want to highlight and underline, which is that and you do this work too. So I'm sure you could echo the sentiment, but there is something that is very cherishable and lovely and amazing about being able to talk to people honestly and authentically about the worst things that have ever happened to them because everyone experiences it, right? And like to get into that all the time, yes, it can be emotionally exhausting, but it's also like very, very lovely and cool in ways, you know, I'll say that too.
Yeah, I mean, I know you were like 50%-ish joking about data entry, but there is hopefully, I'm sure there is, like a sense of purpose that maybe the data entry specifically doesn't have.
Indeed.
Although some people straight up love data and respect to people who are like, dude, let me just fill out this spreadsheet and then my life will be complete. Good for you.
Yeah, like, thank you for being here. Because I need that person. I don't know how to do any, I don't know what a number is. I don't know anything about numbers. I like, they're mythical creatures. So people do need to do that work, and that work is important. But yes, I am cut from the need to do something meaningful and find purpose constantly, you know, or I feel like I'm suffocating kind of DNA.
Got it. Okay, let me also, you described the way that you were wired, quote, before your life fell apart. Can we talk about the falling apart part?
Yeah, I love doing that. Again, I do it all the time, professional. yes. Okay, let's see. Where should we start? It all like happened at once, right? There was like a lot of terrible things that happened all at once. And in my mind, it's just like the bad time. And it was the, like there was before the bad time and after the bad time. And before the bad time, I was an artist and I studied directing and I was a theater person and I wrote and I, you know, so I was always like translating the world through creative output. Also an anime voiceover actor. That's a big secret career of mine. Look me up on IMDb, baby. so I was doing a lot of that stuff. And then I met a wonderful man. This isn't the bad part. He's still my husband. I locked him down.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a brag. That's a brag. Great guy, great guy. He wanted to be with me. Awesome. Worked out for both of us, I hope. And we were going to get married. 3 days before the wedding, my brother, my only brother, my bestest friend brother, some siblings aren't super close. We were not those. We were very close. He called me and told me that he was spending $4,000 a month on opioids. Pills, and that he was an addict, basically. And he needed to let me know before the wedding because he was coming and, you know, he wasn't in great shape. So in my mind, that's like the beginning of this new phase of life where things felt completely out of control and very, very scary. So for like a year, we were on this kind of roller coaster with him of like, will you get help? How do you get help? Are you okay? Are you alive? Are you safe? Can you text me back? Can you call me? Have you heard from him? Have you heard from him? I haven't heard from him. Do you think he's okay? Can somebody go over there? It was that, right? Like living in that place of just constant worry, just worry and anxiety. And like I was in Texas at the time. He was in LA. I couldn't go over there myself. So we were separated by thousands of miles. And it was awful. It's like anyone who's been on that roller coaster with somebody who has substance use disorder knows that it's a very painful place to be. And there's no sort of solid ground to stand on. Around that same time, I got pregnant with my first child. And she was born. And 24 hours after she was born, we found out she failed her newborn hearing screening. That plunged us into yet another sense of what is going on. My daughter ended up being hard of hearing. She wears hearing aids to this day. She's almost 8. She would not like it if I said she was 7. She's like a week away from being 8. So let me clarify that for you.
Sure, yeah.
But it was like more unknown terrain. I was like, I don't know how to do heroin and I don't know how to do deafness. I don't know either of those things. These are new places and I'm diving in. Man, what a theme for this. I'm doving in, right? And I'm like—
So much doving.
Like so much swimming in this episode. This episode is about Olympic lap swimming.
Yes.
So I was, I don't do well with disease. So this time has been great for me. This like COVID time. I'm like constantly afraid of dying and disease and germs. Like I'm bona fide hypochondriac. Like,
it's okay because only everyone has it.
Yeah.
The only people who have it are every single person you see and talk to.
I know. Well, now I'm just like, y'all, welcome to my party. I have been here for a very long time. Welcome. Did you bring a dish? Did you bring me a bottle of wine? It's a great place to live. So I was really scared. And when your kid is born with something, they like scare you intentionally because they need you to take action. I understand the motivation behind this medical choice. A lot of parents are not me. They're not going to go to the doctor the second after they have the conversation because they're so scared of like something going wrong. A lot of parents just had a newborn and they're like, I'm super tired and I'm just going to stay here and breastfeed and change this diaper and everything will be fine. So they like scared. They did a lot of scaring. They were like, she may not ever talk. She may not ever succeed. She may be suicidal one day. I mean, it was like she was a week old and they were, you know.
Holy shit.
Yeah. My husband was like, it's like meeting with the most depressing fortune teller, you know.
But they were saying like her hearing loss gave her a predisposition to be suicidal.
Yeah, like she's going to fail out of school. She's going to, you know, it was like in a packet, you know. It's like, here's a packet of doom. Take home, read it, you know.
Well, I'd never been aware of that. I'm thinking of it as like a side effect of, but that's probably not the right terminology. I never thought of that ever.
Well, what they're trying to say, again, they did it really badly. But what they're trying to say is that like a lot of things in this world can be addressed through early intervention, right? Like early intervention is a thing that is helpful. And if you get your kid's brain, you know, if you're something is happening and you attack it early, it can have lifelong benefits. And they want you to take advantage of the early intervention. And the way that they're trying to do that is to be like, if you don't do it, it's gonna be horrible. And that's kind of what—
There's no recovering.
Yeah. So that happened and it was impactful. And then like, you know, a month after this, while this was all going on and my daughter was 4 weeks old, my brother goes to rehab for the first time. He was in and out of rehab, you know, in and out and in and out, kept relapsing. And then finally, when my daughter turned a year old, I got a call that he died. He overdosed. And and that was a... That was it. It was a bad time. And I, really died internally. I really just shut down. Shut it down. Everyone go home. It was awful. It was awful.
I'm sorry for your loss. That's like 7 years ago, I guess, right? If your daughter's almost eight and she was one around that time.
Yeah. So it's wow. Yeah. 2015, February 2015 is when he passed. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know your brother at all, but as a person who was at that time, like getting into comedy, like the outpouring of love for him in the comedy community was like tremendous. And it was the kind of thing where like, I didn't know him, but you would read the way he'd been eulogized by other comedians and be like, oh, that thing that I thought was so fun. Oh, that's also him and that? And he did, wow. Mm-hmm. And he did that. It felt like preposterous to be like, anyway, but he couldn't have done, I think,
I know.
And this one.
Yeah. It was like annoying. It's like, fuck this guy. Yeah. Like too much, like over the top.
I'm glad you allowed me the space to say that I was mad at him.
Yeah, for sure. You should be.
But so, I mean, all that I know of him in that way is, aside from you obviously telling me that you loved him, is how beloved he must have been by so many people who worked with him and knew him as a friend.
Yeah. He was like the most popular kid at school. Yeah. And I mean, it was also just the timing of it was just almost poetic. You know, he had worked on Parks and Rec for six seasons. And, you know, started as like a little baby writer and then worked his way up to being like co-executive producer on the show. And
is that dogs?
It's the fucking dog, dude. I'm so sorry.
They have something they want to say. We're keeping this in. We're not cutting out any of the dogs. The dogs are in.
I mean, don't. My life is chaos. Yeah, the dogs. This is real life, everyone. This is real. This is what it is.
This is what it is, people. You're talking about your shit. The dogs do not care.
They don't give a shit. They're like, did you know someone is outside? And I'm like, I don't care.
Did you know that I can smell something 600 feet away? That's what I want to tell you about.
I get that you're like on a podcast and you're talking about grief, but I saw a squirrel. Anyway, they're absolute shitheads. They're so cute. I love them so much. And they are ruining my life daily. Ruining it. Okay, so anyway, he died on the 19th. February 19th. My birthday was the 20th. Oof. That was fun. So that's a fun thing that gets to happen every year. And then that week was the series finale of Parks and Rec. So like the whole thing was wrapping, the entire series. The last episode, they had a title card at the end that said, "We love you, Harris." And, you know, it was like...
I feel like, am I going to cry right now?
I mean, are you a monster? You probably should, because it's very sad. It is very sad. Yeah. It was, I mean, you know, this is the thing, man. Like when you, somebody who has like an addiction of some kind, it's hard to understand how somebody that is that incredibly loved and successful and funny, so funny and like just a brain that was like no other brain in the world, how he could have all of this and die by overdose. You know, it's like a hard thing to square. And I've spent a lot of time since he died trying to figure that out and flesh that out and how that's possible and how it happens.
Have you? You said that it's hard to understand. Do you feel like you've come to a place where you have an understanding of it now? Or is it the kind of thing where you like, release the desire to understand it. And it's like there's a distinction between accepting it and understanding it, maybe. I'm making that up, but does that mean anything?
Yeah, no, you're doing a great job. You're doing Sweet. So good.
Okay, I need that. If you wouldn't mind saying that from time to time throughout the episode, it really helped me out.
Listen, I'm a podcaster. We need to be validated. I understand.
Yeah.
I did 26 episodes on this, my show last day. I delved right in. I dove in. And the whole point of the show was like, why did this happen? Did it not have to happen? Should I have done something differently? Why did this person who had all of this promise die this way too early, too young at 30, you know? And like at the same time, the night that he died, 2 hours before, I mean, I can only sort of piece together the time frame, but you know, around 10 o'clock at night, he sent an email to my mom saying, you're gonna love the finale. It's so great. I feel so grateful and so proud, and I love you, and I'm happy. You know, and then he used and he died. So it's you know, we're a really close family, you know, probably too close. There's families that are, you know, close, and then there's my family. We really need more distance, but you know, it changes the whole shape of your life and your family and your. I couldn't go back to my life after that. I had to start over. So that's how I've become a professional griever, because I was doing like normal things that normal people do, and then after this happened, I was like, I am no longer made of flesh or bone, and I need to start over because I have turned into dust, and now I have to put myself back together. And you know, I mean, grief really, 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 really fucked me up, like so bad.
And you're also getting fucked up by it in a time when you probably feel as though you have a lot of attention to pay to other things, also, right? Like you've just had a kid.
Oh, like the human that like is eating from my bosom.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's for example.
Yeah, and the one who like needs to go to the doctor every like 2 weeks because her little baby ears keep growing and they have to keep doing new molds for her hearing aids, and like we're doing like tests and I'm signing forms that are like, you're going to do this MRI and she might wake up brain dead after it, but that's okay. Sign it anyway. Like that kind of stuff. Yeah, I had to do that. I mean, it was like, it was.
Is that a normal MRI thing? Do you have to sign that at every MRI?
Yeah.
Or is that like something because of her?
No, like.
I didn't know. I just sign whatever. I hate those. I hate MRIs. I really don't like them.
Sure.
But babies love them, I'm sure. Babies probably love them.
You're an adult. Like you're an adult. Like if you die, right, it's like. Yeah, fine. When you're doing an MRI, when you're doing an MRI on like a 2-month-old, they're like, listen to me good. This is very serious. She might not wake up, right? Like it's like, yeah. Yeah, it was an intense time. Oh, and then speaking of being too close to my parents, we had a mold infestation. This is icing.
Just to throw something in there.
We had a mold infestation. It was in the baby's room. Anyway, there's mushrooms growing out of the carpet. No.
Not mushrooms.
We had to move to my parents' house.
You can't have vegetables. That's too much.
Not the good kind.
Oh, no.
Not the good kind. Yeah.
Not the good kind. Probably not even the second best kind.
Yeah.
Not even like only just a bad kind.
Not even like a delicacy kind that I could put on a pizza. No, they were like gross.
Right. Not like a shiitake mushroom even.
No. 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 None of the good mushrooms. And we had to basically like be kicked out of the house because, you know, they had to get rid of the mold. And then we had to live with my parents again. And we were like in their little apartment and I had a newborn and my mom would be like, why is she crying? And I'm like, because she's a baby, you know?
The voices that you just used for you and your mom are both insane.
Yeah. And she'd be like, why don't you just give her some Tylenol? And I'm like, because she's a fucking baby, mom.
Right.
And then she'd be like, well, and she's hungry. Give her some formula. Like,
that's good.
I understand.
It's good when someone else is like, I know exactly what your baby needs. You don't know. I know. I know what it is. It's this.
Yes.
Yeah, the maddening, the mushrooms growing out of the carpet is very, very relatable to me. And like when my son died, the idea that like everything in the world doesn't stop, you're like, are you crazy? You can't, like mushrooms, can you not right now? You can definitely grow in like, give me a month to process before you start growing out of the carpet. Would that be okay?
And yet it always does, right? Like, doesn't all the stuff that is the most annoying happen when you're in the depths of despair? It's like,
yeah,
that whole like, well, when it rains, it pours. It actually does.
Yeah.
That actually is the only one of those sayings that is true. It does.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you're in bad shape. You know what else you get? Mushrooms.
Surprise, you've got carpet shrooms.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So what did you, how did you move forward in that time? Like, did you, you and your husband, are you like, you know, separating the, are people jumping in to help you take the kid to the doctor? Or do you just have to keep going at regular life speed because you have no choice?
A little bit of both. So I think my husband definitely picked up a lot of the responsibility of life for like a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't even think I talked to him for a year. I was just like, the only energy I have is to smile at this baby so she's not totally fucked up as an adult. Like I need to just like pretend smile at her and I need to spend any like tiny little reserves of energy I have to connect with her. I don't have anything left over for you, adult man. I have nothing left.
Yeah.
I know we share a room. I understand that you are a warm body that is right there. And I will talk to you once I wake up from this fucking nightmare. And in that time of like being truly catatonic as a human person, and I know you can relate to this, conjuring the energy to stand up, to even put your feet on the floor, like to put a shirt on, to take a shower, any of that stuff that we just take for granted that we do suddenly becomes extraordinarily hard when you are grieving. And it's like the smallest little details become just impossible. And laying down felt like the only way I could be. It was just really like, I have to lay down. I just have to be in bed. And I started writing through this, like not intentionally. I was not intentionally writing. I was literally like putting shit into my notes app because my brain was insanely charged at a level that I just didn't recognize, and I needed to get some of it out. And at some point, Mike was like, my husband, the warm body, was like, why don't you just make that into an essay or something? You know, like you have a lot of writing in your notes app. Do you want to share that? Do you feel like you want to, you know, share that? And I was like, all right, yeah, sure. You know, like, yeah, maybe I should. Maybe I should get it out of my body. Maybe that would help. And I did that. And then that ended up, like, a lot of people read that. And then one of the people who read that was a literary agent. And she was like, do you want to make a book? And I was like, no, I don't want to take a shower. I don't want to put my feet on the floor. But I will continue to do this. And then if you want to try to take whatever this is, and, like, you can, but I'm not. And she was like, yeah, 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 totally, totally. I was like, I can't have any pressure on me at all. I only can smile at a baby right now. You know, that's, like, where it was. And
sure.
So I do think the writing, though, like, gave me an internalized thing. I'm like a doer. I'm a doer by nature, like, yeah. Pathologically. So it gave me, like, a place to put things. And I think it was sort of helpful to get me out of bed eventually. And then I made a book eventually.
And were there other things you did that helped you cope besides just, like, laying face down on the ground and writing?
No. No.
Yeah, that's Mm-mm. fine.
I can't think of anything. I mean, honestly, like, there it was just, like, it was, like, true annihilation. I mean, I do think people helped me. I probably didn't thank them. And I'm sorry, but I think, like, there were wonderful friends who, like, would drop things off, you know, like, make sure people were fed. And there was a lot of love and support. Like, at my time I was teaching, my boss was like, you don't have to come to work. Just don't come to work. Like, I didn't go to work for a month, you know? Like, I don't know why he let me do that. I was thinking about the other day. I was like, who the fuck? Like, that was so nice. He just didn't let me come to work for a month, and he still paid me and, like, let me keep my job.
My boss, I was working at a tutoring company at the time, and it was a similar thing where he was just like, yeah, you don't just come back whenever. Whenever you want to come back, just come back then. And they paid me while I was away, and I was like, this is crazy. Thank you.
I know. That stuff, though, that, like, people are good stuff was very apparent, you know?
Yeah.
And they weren't even, like, bombarding me with it, right? Like, I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to say any words out loud to anybody. And so they would just text me and they'd be like, there's dinner at your door, or I got you some groceries and dropped them off, or I'm going to take Iris for a couple hours to the park, or, you know.
And that was also, to me, a lot of that was the best shit, where it's someone just like, I am telling you the thing I'm about to do for you, and it is done. As opposed to the, hey, what can I do?
Where can we like put that?
Yeah.
Like, what? I will rip your face off if you ask me what you can do. I don't know what you can do. I can't put on shoes.
Yeah.
Why am I supposed to tell you what to do?
I'm licking mushrooms off my carpet. Do whatever you want.
Like, this is like, I'm like, only people who have, like, been annihilated by grief, like, get this. But I do feel like it is something we need to share. Everybody needs to take one thing away from this, which is that when someone is in shit, the shit, don't you dare ask them what you can do or how they're doing. Those are the two things you need to, you know, they're fucked up and they have no idea what you can do. So just say, I am bringing you dinner tonight. It will be there at 6. I'm going to knock on your door and run away.
I just leave it there. I'm gone.
That's it.
Oh, that's the dream. The dream is, mystery person who left this lasagna here, I don't know who you are, but I will never forget you.
Truly. That's the way. That is the way to do it.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
When I like think about that time, I just think like a year, there was a year that I just wasn't in my body. I don't know. Do you have like a, do you think like, was there a period of time where you were just not anchored to the earth?
Yeah, I think yes, the answer is yes. I think for me, the way that like our son died when he was like just over a month old. So, you know, it's a very different experience. I mean, everyone's thing is different, but I guess like if, you know, your thing could be maybe like looking through all these memories you have, and mine is more like, oh, it's an empty photo album of like, there's just nothing in here. But there's that part of it. And there's also the fact that, even though he's our son, it felt like a thing that there was a blast and I was there with my wife, but she was just like a little bit closer to it than I was. Like she had just, the pregnancy was so difficult and she had done like so many things like and made herself so uncomfortable and all this stuff, like just to there, you know, we had twins. And so one of them died. She had done all of this to just to have them be alive when they were born. And we thought like they were in the hospital, like, oh, they're going to be good. Like they're recovering. Everything's going to be good. So when this happened, it felt like she had invested, even though I had invested all that I knew how to in it, mm-hmm. she had invested more by the nature of biology. And so it felt like a thing that it hit me, but it hit her more. And so in my own mind, without her telling me to do this or anyone asking me to, I kind of went into like, okay, let's just like, what can you do to make sure she's okay? Mode.
Yep.
And like wasn't fully even processing my own thing. It was more like this, okay, this is the way that I knew how to defend myself was to be like, this isn't really happening to you. It's happening to her. And so like you like help her out, make sure she's okay. And at the same time, privately from time to time, I mean, and also it wasn't like I was hiding it from her, but I just wasn't fully aware of how sad I was.
Totally.
Until like a good while later when I was like, oh, you know what? Sometimes I'll just be talking to someone and my eyes will fill with tears. And it's like, you know what? You might be sad.
Yeah. Yeah. You might need a good cry.
Oh, okay. that's good. You are hired. So there was definitely a long period of time. I mean, I certainly remember in the hospital when we found out that Fisher was going to die. I remember being in like, there was this room that they had put us in, that was normally reserved for people, I think, who are about to take their babies home. They had us like in this like little private room by the NICU. And I remember my wife saying to me through like, you know, a cascade of tears, how am I ever going to be happy again? And I remember like that feeling I distinctly remember of like, you know, I really being like, I mean, fuck, I don't know. I honestly, lady, I don't know.
That makes me cry.
Lying and being like, don't worry, for sure. I promise you will be saying that, being like, I have no idea. I don't know if we'll survive this. So,
oh my God.
I remember that feeling for a long time. And that question like being implanted in my head of like, what can we do to make sure that this good woman can be happy in her, you know, in her life.
Yeah.
And there's the other part of that for me was it gave me a purpose. It gave me like something, it gave me something to do, to be like, okay, well,
yeah,
yeah, here's what I can do. I can do this. I mean, not that I was good at it or that I do not want to paint myself as someone who was like put on the armor and the lance and was constantly out there doing good stuff for her. I'm a garbage person.
Sure.
I haven't gotten any better.
Absolutely.
But in my mind—
I can see that about you.
Yeah. They told you, right? The producers usually tell people that I'm a problem.
This guy, garbage person.
This guy's so a garbage man.
yeah.
I don't know, remember what your question was. But anyway, there was a long period of time where I felt incapacitated.
Yes.
And then, like, I had to go back to work eventually. At the time, I was working as a private tutor. I was teaching people how to take standardized tests. And I would be with students. I had students before my son died. And then they had to tell those people, like, hey, Michael's not going to be in for a couple months. P.S. his son died. Do you want to work with him when he comes back? And I don't blame half of those 16-year-olds for being like, fuck no.
Yeah.
I absolutely do not want to come after school and sit with the guy whose kid just died.
Yeah.
So I can learn what ancillary means or whatever. It's not worth it to me.
I mean, I was literally working with 16-year-olds also at the time. I was teaching high school.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like that's...
Oh, see? That's amazing.
I taught high school theater at a performing arts high school. So I was dealing not only with just like normal teenagers, but like theater teenagers.
Yeah. Kids who are the most teenager.
Yeah. Yeah. The most teenager you could possibly be, who like have to like come into your office and just cry at you constantly. Right. Like, you know, and I had to quit soon after because I couldn't do it anymore. I was like, I can't emotionally be available for you anymore. I can't do it.
Yeah. Totally.
You need too much and I have nothing to give you.
I did. I felt a lot of like disassociation from those kids and from everybody after that. But I do remember you talk about people being good to you. I do remember my daughter, who is alive and in my home right now, after she was born, there was like a period of time where she just like stopped breathing. My wife was breastfeeding her and she stopped breathing. And I was like, oh my God, is my daughter going to die now too? This is crazy. My wife called me and I was in the middle of tutoring, but I saw that she had called and I knew that she was at the hospital. I picked up, I like tried to act chill while I was talking to her, but I was with a student just sitting there. And I kind of like in a trance got up and was like, I think I have to go, and took my stuff and started to I couldn't get a cab. So I was trying to walk to the hospital, which was insane. It was like, it's far.
Yeah.
And my student came around the corner and was like, hey, do you want me, like I can have my driver take us to the hospital if you want. And I just remember being like, oh, we're not even close. That's nice. That's a nice thing. I didn't even know that you were nice. I didn't know that. I don't know you.
Yeah.
This is a nice thing you're saying.
I'm hung up on the 16-year-old had a driver. What kind of children were you working with? What are you saying?
I was working with predominantly the students I was working with were quite well off.
Wow.
Not there. We would do like some pro bono tutoring, which was like for, you know, kids who couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
But the tutoring in general was for people who had
drivers.
It was quite expensive.
Wow.
For a student to have a driver was not uncommon. I would say it would be weird for a student to not have a driver.
So you were like the gold standard.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I did like one job that I was truly horribly suited for when I lived in New York, one of my like many jobs where I like was an assistant preschool teacher, I think, for a second on the Upper West Side. And I never met a single parent. I only knew nannies. I was like, I know you have a kid and that is your person that takes care of you. And I don't know if you have any parents. I'm not sure.
There's no proof.
Don't think you do. But yeah, I'm familiar with that brand of person. Yes.
Sure.
I don't know how we got here, but yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what this podcast is about anymore. I don't know what I'm talking about. I want to talk about a little bit about your daughter too. So does that mean that you sign with her or do you, because of her hearing aids,
mm-hmm.
I'm very scared to say the wrong words when I talk about anything. So
I'm open to
being chastised.
I know. I love that. Like, I feel like that's just where we are right now, right? Like, everyone's like, I want to say the right words and I will not, but I want to.
Yes. I just want to preface what I'm saying with I'm trying to say the right words.
Yeah. Totally. I know.
I had a student who had hearing aids or implants, mm-hmm. or it was like
the cochlear implant.
Yeah.
Cochlear implant. Mm hmm. Yep.
And the way that she was a teenager, she probably still is. No, she's got to be in her 20s now. But she looked cool. I had never seen them before. And the way, like, just her whole vibe, I was like, oh, those look awesome.
Yeah. You're like part robot. Like, you're bionic.
Yeah.
It actually, like, you are cool. You are cooler than the average person.
Yeah, it made her seem from the future.
Let me open this door for a second because this dog is whining and going to be louder than if I just
get that dog.
You are killing me. I hate you. And I love you. Okay, let me answer your question. So Okay, my daughter, yes. So my daughter's hard of hearing. We actually just had her annual hearing test yesterday. And every time we do, I'm like a ball of nerves, Hey, no, you have to come back out. Come on.
We tried. Listen, dog, we tried. We did. We really did.
We tried. I tried. You lose. You know what? Actually, go over here. I swear to God, I'm going to answer this question. I promise.
I can't wait.
Okay.
I mean, I can't wait. Take your time, but I also can't
wait. Thank you. Have you ever had a guest that's like this fucking frazzled?
Yes. The answer is yes.
Good. I'm glad. The thing with Iris is that we got her... I think she was the youngest baby to ever be in speech therapy. She started speech therapy at 5 weeks old.
Oh, wow.
Right? Like I said, I'm a doer. I was like, what are you going to do with a baby in speech therapy? I mean, I'll do it if you tell me to, but I don't really understand the concept. And what they do is that they, you know, they'll nurse and then they'll like shake a rattle or something. And if she stops sucking, then you're like, oh, you heard that. Good job. So you're basically training the baby to listen. Like you're wiring the brain because it's just harder when you are hard of hearing to listen. Those pathways just like aren't as there. So then once they can sort of make sounds, you'll be like, do you want the rattle? And they're like, and you're like, oh good, you heard that. And then that turns into words, right? So she's like, not only can she hear, but she's probably the best listener I've ever seen. I'm like, I actually think that every child in the world needs speech therapy as a baby. Like, I think it would help with everything, actually. Like, she's 7 now. She raises herself. She pays rent. I don't do anything for her. She's, like, she's the most mature person I know. Not just a child. She's more mature than me.
Sure.
She's more mature than my mother.
Than me, for sure.
Oh, my God. Like, she's functioning on a different playing field, I feel like. She's one of those humans that's just, like, she just has a magic thing about her, right? Like, she's great. I love her. She's great. She's also annoying. She's a kid and, you know, whatever. But
sure, no, of course.
But
of
she's course. She's really great. And she hears, she talks, you know, she had to work on it. She had to work. She was in deep speech therapy for years. But she's in a mainstream classroom. She wears her hearing aids. She uses, like, an amplification system. And... she can connect her iPad to her hearing aid through Bluetooth. So she's like basically just constantly streaming shit on her iPad and ignoring me.
And you could never even know.
It's actually great. Like I don't have to hear the crap that she listens to. it actually has worked out great. Like, but yeah, so she's what we call she's a moderate hearing loss, which means that when she doesn't have her hearing aids in, you have to like scream at her like she's a grandma or something. Like, you know, what I said, you know, you just sort of like overemphasize. When she has him in, you wouldn't know it. Speaks beautifully and reads lips. So the pandemic has been a little tricky because everyone is wearing masks. So
right.
There's been like a
I never thought about that.
A layer of challenge for her. And then my son has a different kind of deafness. So he is profoundly deaf in his left ear and has typical hearing in his right.
Is that hereditary or something or just?
Nope. My pediatrician, here's how he said it. I was like, so were we just struck by lightning twice? And he's like, yeah, pretty much, yep. I was like.
That's the best feeling when your doctor's like, well, geez, I never seen this before.
Literally. We've been to several doctors that are like, seriously? Like, wow, can I see the, can we study you? I'm like, no, I don't.
I'd rather you didn't, thank you.
I don't need to be studied.
But does receiving her diagnosis initially, Iris, right? Receiving her diagnosis originally sounds like it was another like gut punch at that time. Does it continue to feel that way as she gets older or now is it like this is kind of no big deal?
Yeah, now it's like 100% no big deal. But 8 years ago, it felt like a death. It felt like I had a plan. I'm sure you relate. Your wife could relate.
Yeah.
I had a vision of how this was going to work. I had a movie in my mind about all of the wonderful things we were going to do together. And how lovely it was all going to be. And then it was not like that at all. It was like living in the hospital, worrying, Googling, catastrophizing. You know, I mean, it's shocking now to look back. And I do have these moments where I'm like, oh, like, why did you rob me of this time? You know, like, if I could have fast-forwarded and seen how phenomenal she was going to turn out and how, like, it wasn't a problem. You know, it was presented like a problem. It felt like a problem. Ultimately, she is like any other kid, better, I think. I'm biased. I think she's better.
Sorry, she's better.
And, you know, yeah, it's like we go to the audiologist once a year and she like, I don't even deal with her. I don't touch the hearing aids. She changes her batteries. She takes them in. She takes them out. She cleans them. Like, she's in charge. So.
And is your son's hearing condition, do you think if he had been born first with this condition that you would have felt about it the way that you felt about Iris's condition? Do you know what I mean?
No, because, like, no.
Because to me, like, the first and second child thing, like, I mean, one of our first children died, so obviously our situation's a little bit magnified, but definitely, like, the level of anxiety that every single thing our kids, the twins, did was terrifying to us. With our daughter, who is slightly younger, we're like, she's fine. Oh, she fell down a full staircase into a hail of bullets. She's going to be fine.
I think I cried. We went to the audiologist. She gave me the news. I fell to my knees. I sobbed on the floor.
Sure.
Got up, went home, saw my mother-in-law sitting there. Was like, ugh, yeah. Went to the shower, cried in the shower. In the shower, said to myself, I don't have fucking time to do this. I don't have time to do this. I can't do this. I can't do this again. You know what? She's fine. He's going to fucking be fine. You need to pull your shit together, lady, and get on out the shower, dry off, and go make a meal for people. Like, this was literally, like, I was fine. It was truly, like, I was, like, I felt the feelings. I did the big cry. I fell on the floor. And then I was, like, his life will be fantastic. Like, this is not going to change things.
It is, like, an amazing thing that I think people can do, I can do, I don't know if all people, and it sounds like you can, sometimes where you're like, I think I'm going to decide to not have this feeling. I think I'm going to decide to have a different feeling right now. And I know that's not like great psychological practice in many, many cases. I'm not endorsing it all the time. But sometimes it's like, I need to just tell myself to just be chill for a minute.
I honestly think it's like, there is a perspectiveness that you have if you've like been through the true darkness where you're like, this is not that, right? Like, I think like because, and I'm a feeler, man. Like, I am a feeler. I will feel it all, okay? I am a feeler.
Just try to feel more than I feel. You can't.
You can't. You cannot. You are not able to. But I would say since like everything like fell apart and was awful, that there are moments where I'm like, we're not going to do that. Like, you have this many hours to feel bad and you can live in that place and then you're going to need to, like, go to the grocery store, you know?
Is that a real thing that you're saying? That, like, you will be like, okay, I'm allocating myself. I'm going to take the calendar. I'm going to be like, okay, so on Thursday we can be sad. Thursday can be a sad day. And then the next sad day I think could be the following Wednesday.
I mean, I don't think it's that. Yeah, I don't think it's, well, but also like,
I think people do try to do that though, to be like, I'm going to give myself an hour in the day where I'm going to be like, this will be the day where no one look at me or breathe on me.
Yeah. I mean, I, like I said, I mean, yeah, when I'm deeply grieving, I love to be in bed, but I do love to be in bed always. Like, I love to nap. if I can shut down, like, I'm happy to do it. I love shutting down. But yeah, I mean, I think it's less deliberate. I think it's less deliberate than that. But again, like, because I do spend my entire life like listening to sad things and talking about sad things, and like, I'm crying about other people's sad stories all the time. Like, I'm cleansing a lot. So I don't know. I just feel like there's not a need to like delve as deeply into those moments. And like you said, like, I had practice. I had a child that had a disability. It did not negatively impact her life at all. She's super. I'm like, wait a minute. If he turns out like her, That's good.
Yeah, we're set.
So, okay, fine. You know, like, we're good. He's not like her, okay? He's not. They are different people.
Of course.
He's very, very cute. Very cute.
Yeah.
Did we send him to preschool this week for the first time in 2 years because of the pandemic? Yes. Did his teacher say to me, he needs to do his pants by himself, he needs to put his shoes on by himself, he needs to use his boards? I'm like, why the fuck do you think he's in school?
Yeah. That's why I brought him to you, lady. That's why he's here.
Like, he is feral. You are right. You understand him. Yes, he has been a wild animal that has not been exposed to any other people for 2 years. Here you go.
That's amazing. Wait. Oh, I'm realizing now that I'm having too good of a conversation with you. I've forgotten to ask you several questions that I mean to ask people. So rapid fire. Just kidding. We just won't get through them all. But I wanted to ask about, so you're in grief all the time, mm-hmm. right? Not necessarily that you are feeling grief, although maybe you are, but also like occupationally you have taken this on a lot. Can you just talk about what you do and what that's like?
Yeah. Can you hear the dog whining and screaming and crying? Like, is it ruining this?
I actually don't hear it at all.
You don't? Okay. All right.
But if you need to go and now I do hear it.
Mm-hmm. Hang on one second. I am so sorry.
I'm obsessed with this. It is great.
Hold on. Let me just like love on him for a second. Hold on. What? We're just going to do it this way now.
Can't wait.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
The dog's going to be in here in 1 minute.
I know. He's like crawling in. Okay. What I do. So I was going to have the second kid and I was like a week away from giving birth. And I got a cold email from this woman who had lost her brother the same way that I had lost mine. And she was the executive producer of Pod Save the People with DeRay, Crooked Media, and was like, do you want to come on the show? And like, I'd love to do some first person stuff. And so I was like, all right, I'll talk to this lady. Like, I love that show. I love DeRay. Like, yeah. All right, you're out. Let's go. Come on. Get out. You're ruining everyone's lives, especially Michael. He's so nice. And he's done nothing to you. Oh my God, I'm sweating so hard. So she reached out to me. Basically, we like had this long conversation. And at the very end, she was like, I want to do a podcast about opioids and about like overdose stuff. Do you want to do that? And I was like, no. No. That sounds horrible. I am not going to spend any more time talking about heroin. Okay. I wrote a book about it. I've like grieved. I'm done. So, you seem great. I actually do like you very much. We can chat after I like, you know, stop wearing the mesh underwear and, you know, bleeding so profusely after giving birth, you know? And I don't know. It was like one of those maybe universe cosmic-y things, but I scrolled by this article that opioids are killing more people than car accidents. And I basically emailed her right away and was like, all right, fuck it. I think I literally said like, fuck it, fine. I'll do this with you. And we started working on this show called Last Day that I host. We're on season 3 right now. And first season was on opioids. Second season was on suicide. Third season is on guns. So fun stuff, not at all complex and complicated and layered.
And very light.
Very light, like lots of comedy. I do make jokes as much as I can on the show. And we basically decided that life was really hard and shitty for people in a lot of ways, not just heroin, and made a few other shows and then created a network. We call it Lemonada. We have 20 shows now. We have 40 staff members. I don't know. This is what I do now. So I have a media company.
Look at you.
Yeah.
You're a business.
Yeah. I'm really put together, very polished.
Aside from how much I'm sure the shows you produce help other people, does it help you?
The first season helped me tremendously. I mean, the first season, like you asked me earlier, did you find an answer? I totally did. I was able to, by the end of the first season, absolve myself of a lot of guilt that I had, that I didn't do enough, which I think is just a common feeling when you're left, when you survive somebody that you love and you think like, well, I must have done something wrong, right? And so that was extremely helpful. I got a lot of crying out during that season. If you listen to that season, I mean, I am in it. I am holding nothing back. So the first season was really helpful. And then I think like moving forward, it's, you know, you have people who are newly in their grief. I'm sure you get this all the time where somebody is in that annihilated place and they're reaching out to you because they're like, you lived through this. Am I going to make it, right? It's that thing your wife said, will I ever be happy again? And like 7 years later, I'm like, yeah, you'll always be a little sad. Like I'm always going to be a little sad. I might, maybe was always just sad a little bit. Like melancholy, the infant sadness over here, you know, always. But like,
right.
I think it's really amazing to be able to say to somebody like, yeah, it's, you're not always going to feel this way, you know? And that, I like being able to do that. I like that.
Do you feel like grief has changed you in some way? You talked about like maybe you were always a little bit sad, but are there ways in which you feel like, the feeling of grief has changed you as a person?
Well, it certainly changed my like life's trajectory. I don't think I would be doing anything that I'm doing right now had I not had these experiences. And I think that in some weird way it has like calmed me down a little bit. Like, I used to be afraid of everything. I used to be afraid. I'm like so much anxiety my whole life, and being afraid that things are going to happen that are bad. And then when they do and you're able to like keep going and the fear of the bad thing isn't like a monster as much anymore. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's like, there's a perspective that I think I have gotten where I'm like, this is okay. You're going to be fine. Everyone's healthy. Everyone's safe. Everyone's fine. It's okay. You know? And that feels different. I think I was more almost high strung and afflicted with anxiety before.
Oh, see, I think that's a great way to process that. I think that makes sense to me, but I think there's a different way that it could go, right? Which is like more anxiety of like, oh shit, anything could all the time, anything can happen.
That was certainly the case the first year. Like I would say anxiety became the primary color the first year. I was like, every time Mike and Iris left the house, they're going to die. Every time anything happens, they're going to die. Everyone's going to die. Die, 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 die. Like it just became the color of everything. And then once you kind of got through that acute portion of that, I was like, they didn't die. They're here. I love them. She's so great. You're so great. And, like, I can feel joy. I can choose to feel joy. I can choose to feel joy. Oh my gosh. It's just like this agency that I like, that I found over my life experience. I don't know. I don't know.
I love that. That's so great. That's the second time we've talked about it. But that idea that like, you know what? I've had decided that I think I can, I have some direction here. I can point myself at places.
Yeah.
Which I think as like, as you're saying, in the first year or like, or whatever that first amount of time is, you're often like, I think the only way I can go is literally down. I think down is the only direction that I have.
I also think like probably humans who are not me didn't spend an entire year just feeling shitty. Like I was fine. I didn't push it away at all. I was just deep in it. I was just mourning and grieving and hating things and feeling scared and sleeping and crying for a year, you know? And I had amazing people and I had a great husband and no one rushed me through that. I went to therapy like twice a week. I upped my medication. I mean, I did it all, you know? And I like felt it all. And so when I was ready to stop being there, I was ready, you know? I think a lot of people, when I talk to people, they don't give themselves that permission to go so deeply into it. And I think ultimately dwelling in the grief and being in the bad place and the darkness until I was ready to not be was probably pretty critical.
Yeah, that sounds like great. I mean, if you're able to do that, to take the time to feel it all is Great advice.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you also, do you think of your brother as somewhere now? Like, is there, do you communicate with him in any way? I'm not being like that he's an angel or whatever, or that like, but well, I mean, unless you think he is.
He's not. He's definitely not. No.
But do you like, do you envision him someplace or like, you know, feel him in your daily life in any way or, you know, anything?
I mean, I'm not in my current like space right now, but when I am in my space, he's everywhere. I have like all of his artwork, all of like, his paintings of him, his little stupid like dolls. And he was like a boy man, his like stuffed things. And I have that shit everywhere. I have, you know, furniture of his. He's just everywhere. I feel he is literally wherever I look, he is there. And my kids talk about him. I talk about him. You know, this company was born out of this loss. Like he's around all the time. And he's present all the time. And I don't know. I think the first year I like needed to see him in birds that flew by or like the signs like, oh, there's a feather. That must be him. Like I was sort of doing that. Where do you see him? Oh, it's the wind. It must be him, you know? And
sure, sure.
And I was like, my mom used to do that. And I was like, oh God, please, he's not the wind, you know? And then I was like, maybe he is the wind. And then there was like a moment where like there was this possums going back and forth on my fence. And I was like, that is definitely him. That possum is him.
I love that idea of your mom being like, he's the wind. You're like, your mom, you're full of shit. He's obviously the possum.
Yeah. He was like, there was this fucking possum that would walk back and forth like on my fence like every day and kind of just like stop and look at me a little bit. And then one day like the possum came by with like an actual baby possum on his back and then like kept going. He would like come home. It was like the possum would like cross at like 5 o'clock, like after work or something, you know? And I was like, that's definitely him. And I think the more time that has passed, I don't see him concretely like that. I don't think I need to as much. Like, I don't need to look for him. I just sort of feel that he's here and, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, in the year I talked to him, I wrote a whole book to him. I was like, you are blah, blah, blah. And the editor was like, that was such a great, like, how did you decide to do that? I was like, what are you talking about?
Well, oh, there was a different way?
Yeah. She was like, you know, you're speaking to him. He's like, you know, and I was like, that I didn't choose that. That is, I am speaking to him. I'm like, fuck you. Why did you do this? And also like, oh my God, could you believe what Dad did? I mean, I was just like really talking to him more after he died than I think I probably did when he was alive. Yeah. All the time. Lots of conversations.
Well, I loved this. I would talk to you forever, maybe.
I bet you say that to all the guests. All the guests.
No, most of our episodes end with me saying, go fuck yourself. And then hanging up the call.
Love that. Good.
Okay. This was another episode of A Good Cry. Thanks for doing this, Steph. I hope it helps. You know, subscribe and do all those things. I hope you will. Bye. Love you. A Good Cry is produced by Radio Point and HeadGum with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, Richard Corson, Daniel Powell, and Houston Snyder. Recorded, edited, and mixed by Bree Mattan.
All right, you're out. Let's go. Come on.
That was a HeadGum podcast.